There? Gary, are you there? The time now is exactly 12 minutes. 1 minute after 12. Gary Null, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Okay, good. We're ready to go. So, do you have my theme music?
We'll re-cue it.
Thank you.
Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with the ongoing series, Exploring AIDS, A Second Opinion. This is part three in this series. Up to this point, we have presented just some of the information that would challenge the prevailing view that HIV is the single cause of AIDS, which represents 30 different syndromes, that virtually 99% of the entire medical and scientific community accepts that this is a reality. Hence, all of our research into vaccines, antiviral drugs, have been focused for the past 15 years in this direction. What if, however, virtually everything that we had believed about AIDS was wrong? What if it were not just one dissident view, such as Dr. Peter Duisberg, a leading critic of this single virus causing all these syndromes issue, but rather there are thousands of doctors and scientists, Nobel Prize winners, virologists, molecular biologists, who are saying, we must reappraise our position. We are in a medical Vietnam. This, then, is an in-depth investigation to explore what the mainstream media has, unfortunately, until this time, not taken upon itself to do. I will continue today by first giving you a little background into some of the other issues that are also involving AIDS, but rarely, if ever, get any attention. And then we'll go into asking, what are the facts supporting the establishment point of view? Look at the facts, no emotions, no opinion, no politics, just facts. Before we go there, this is from Peter Richards from Porta, Spain. I'll quote it. It's about in the islands there in Trinidad and Tobago. They're using an AIDS vaccine trial. Quote, it was supposed to be their moment of glory. After years of campaigning, the Trinidad and Tobago governments this week finally gave the green light for local researchers to be a part of an international campaign against the deadly HIV virus that causes AIDS. But instead, the researchers and their supporters have been taking to the radio, television, and other media in a bid to assure the public that the HIV vaccine trials are safe and that participants will not end up contracting the deadly disease. The vaccine is being developed through an alliance involving medical researchers in Brazil, Haiti, Trinidad, and Tobago with the Institut Pasteur and the Institut of Mérac in France and Canada's Connaught Laboratories. The vaccine uses canary pox vectors to transport HIV genes to the host cells. Volunteers here would be participating in phase two of the trials, which test the efficacy of the vaccine. In Trinidad and Tobago, officials show that 1,200 new cases of AIDS were reported last year and 17,000 persons living with HIV/AIDS in the country. But the controversy over the vaccine trial has come about as a result of a statement Health Minister Dr. Hamas Rekwe made in Parliament this week while announcing that Cabinet had agreed for the island to participate in the international effort. In his prepared text, the doctor said that before Cabinet had given its approval, it had sought clarification from a government-appointed committee on a number of specific issues, including whether or not the vaccine would make those who receive it HIV positive. According to Rafik, some concerns took the form of the following questions, such as, is the vaccine likely to cause the disease AIDS? To which the committee made up of medical, church, trade union, and university lecturers said, no, highly unlikely. But when the committee was asked, will the vaccine make those who receive it HIV positive, The doctor said the response was yes. Immunization with these vaccines will result in HIV antibody positivity. However, tests are available, and the Medical Research Foundation of Trinidad and Tobago has access to these biochemical tests, which can differentiate between vaccine-produced positivity and native infected positivity, unquote. Now, here is the issue. For those of you who have been listening to this program for any period of time, you know that I have recently commenced a series on examining the safety and efficacy of vaccines, looking strictly at peer-reviewed literature from mainstream scientific journals. It is no longer a question of will people get sick from vaccines. Virtually all the studies that I have cited shows that those who were vaccinated were actually at higher levels of risk for the very condition they were supposed to be protected from. I gave you instances of smallpox, rubella, pertussis, measles, all having fully been vaccinated, they come down with the disease. I also showed that there are contaminants in the vaccines, and that frequently the contaminants have caused substantial reactions in individuals, both short-term and delayed. Sometimes the individual's not realizing they have had an adverse effect for a long period of time after. Now, here is the question. They now claim that they have a vaccine for a virus that has been so elusive that until just 2 years ago, they couldn't have a photograph of it. And then when they did produce a photo of it, as I reported on my first part of this series, a group of researchers in London challenged the authenticity that it was an actual HIV virus. And indeed, when they went to the original medical library source where the photo that was published in the newspapers and magazines came from, it was an artist rendition. In other words, taking existing viruses and then adding on what they perceived would be the look of this virus. The trouble is, no one was told this is a facsimile. This is a rendition. People thought, gee, now we know what the HIV virus actually looks like. A number of leading dissident virologists, including Dr. Stefan Lanka and Dr. Elena Papadopoulos, Heliopoulos of the Perth Group, Dr. Val Turner, came forward and said, this is a fraud. If you're going to show hepatitis virus, it's easy. You take a person who has hepatitis antibody and antigens, and you can culture the virus very quickly from the blood. The same for herpes, cytomegalovirus. In fact, almost all viruses, very easy to culture it and then reproduce a photograph of it. They hadn't been able to do this with HIV virus, so they gave us artistic renditions, hence composites that are made up. Well, that is not good science. And so now the question is, how do you vaccinate against behavior? How do you vaccinate against taking amyl nitrate or having hepatitis or all the other risk factors that have been shown to be more causative than this so-called lone virus? Now, let's just say that there were no other risk factors. Everyone in the world was equally capable and susceptible to coming down with AIDS from this HIV retrovirus in the Lenta family, which means slow acting. Well, based upon the current research across the board in all of virology, there would be a high probability that the people receiving this vaccine, if it worked, or if there was no other cause, would come down with the very disease that they're being vaccinated for. Now, currently there are movements afoot to identify anyone who is HIV positive and mandate by law that they must undergo intensive chemotherapy using AZT, DDI, antiretroviral cocktails. And these have historically been shown to cause high incidence of iatrogenic episodes, drug-induced episodes. In fact, many of the critics, after examining people who were HIV positive but healthy had no symptoms. Once they began to take the drugs, supposedly to help them, that's when they got sick. And universally, their sicknesses were very similar, because the side effects from the drugs are very similar. Which then told these researchers that you could not distinguish HIV caused by, or AIDS caused by a virus versus AIDS caused by taking the medication to treat the virus. I have interviewed over 2,000 scientists, activists, who hold that feeling. That is why they believe that Kimberly Burgalis, Ryan White, and others, Arthur Ashe, died. They did not die of AIDS. They died of gross immune suppression due to the adverse side effects of high levels of these antiretrovirals and antibiotics. On the other hand, there are 15,000 long-term survivors who were diagnosed with AIDS but chose either to start and stop because of the side effects of the drugs, or never took the drugs and instead chose for healthier options: detoxification, cleansing, rebalancing. Those individuals today are alive and well. I have interviewed hundreds and hundreds of them. I presented over 44 of them in a recent documentary I did called AIDS: The Real Heroes, showing how their lifestyle and behavior affected their immune system, and interviewed a leading group of psychoneuroimmunologists who showed that a person's stress levels and environmental toxins, attitude, could directly impact their immune system. So now you take a vaccine, you end up being HIV positive, because after all, what you're doing is you're actually giving the actual low level of something that is supposed to stimulate the immune system to a person so the body will create antibodies against it. Well, here is the issue. The body already has antibodies. What would be the purpose of additional antibodies? They claim they can distinguish the difference between the virus antibodies caused by the vaccine and the virus antibodies caused by the HIV. I've seen no literature on this. I've seen no proof of this. And since we're mandating laws that would be draconian, extremely difficult to get around, you could just be a normal, regular person who happens to have a false positive reaction, and suddenly you have a social worker showing up your door with a court order that if you don't go to a clinic and start taking AZT, you could be imprisoned, or you could be forced to take the medication. We are moving towards isolating and quarantining everyone with HIV in our society. They've done this in Cuba. They are doing it elsewhere. And we watch what others do, and then we say it's in the public interest. It is not in the public interest. But that's one of the things I just wanted to show you is occurring. And most of the time, people are not aware of this. This is something else. This comes from Fox News. I'll quote verbatim. October 31st, year 2000. A new drug once believed to be a major weapon against AIDS has instead turned out to be a major disappointment. Doctors studying HIV immunogen, a substance made from the protein of an inactivated human immunodeficiency virus, expected the drug to slow down the progression of the disease by boosting the immune system of patients who had not yet developed full-blown AIDS. But a four-year study led by Dr. James Kahn of the University of California, San Francisco, has just proved that the treatment does not work. 4 years ago, Kahn and his team treated a group of 2,500 HIV-infected patients with HIV immunogen and then waited for the results. Not only did the drug not work as planned, but according to an article in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association, it was so obviously ineffective that an outside group of investigators monitoring the study ordered it called off several months before the experiment was scheduled to end. Quote, they recommended that the study in fact be halted and that the patients be released from the study so they could find other ways to receive treatment. Unquote. Very serious side effects, no benefit, and yet one more of the giant benefits so-called AIDS researchers had come up with ended up not to work. Now, this is even more serious. This comes from Fenton Doon, editor of Virimmune Investigations, AIDS Rethinking News. And this is something that I did not see in any of the major media. Nevirapine, approved by the FDA in June of 1996, became the ninth drug approved by the FDA for the treatment of people with HIV infection. Boehring Ingraham, New Zealand Medicine's safety authority website, the site warns of severe and life-threatening skin reactions such as Stevens-Johnson syndrome, including fatal cases occurring in patients treated with Vimerimmune. It warns that Vimerimmune must be discontinued in patients developing a severe rash. Quote, dose escalation should not occur if rash is observed during the lead-in period until the rash is resolved. The site also states that the major side effect of nevirapine is a rash, which happened in 22% of the people in studies. 6% where it was very severe. And then it shows photographs of the people who were using it, and they were extremely terrible photographs. And these were in South Africa, where the nevirapine trials were being conducted. And if you look at these people, you find that it's a rash that kills in a flesh-eating flare-up. So in effect, you have a flesh-eating side effect of a drug used to treat AIDS, and it looks like the person's entire face is totally filled with blisters, and it shows Julie, a 10-month-old baby, with her mouth filled with blisters. Her face is virtually unrecognizable. She looked like she had been deep-fried. Her lungs collapsed, and she lost all sight in her right eye. There have been 5 deaths attributed to using these antiretrovirals. And that is considered a gross underestimation of the risk. So here we have gross disfigurement, a flesh-eating side effect. And when you look at the complications, it looks like someone who had just gotten out of Nagasaki about a month after the H-bomb with massive radiation burns. This is the side effect of this drug that is being heralded in the war against AIDS, killing people, disfiguring people for life, and causing flesh-eating side effects. And that is what the AIDS establishment is supporting. Now, this comes from USA Today, October 26, year 2000. New guidelines for prenatal AIDS fight. Drugs used to prevent the transmission of the AIDS virus, HIV, from pregnant women to their babies should be offered to all HIV-positive women who are about to give birth, the United Nations AIDS program said Wednesday. Previous recommendations held that the drug should be used only in small-scale pilot studies and other research programs. Research has shown that the drugs Nevirapine alone, that's the one I just cited, that kills people, cause the babies to go blind, and looks like they've been, quote, deep-fried with blisters all over their face, totally distorted. That is what they're recommending along with AZT, alone or in combination. Quote, they are safe for both mothers and infants. Well, USA Today, do your homework. And the UN, you have no knowledge or no business saying anything about AIDS. This is the bad part of the politics of AIDS. And will you hear any of the gay organizations saying anything? Not when you see how much money they receive from Burroughs Wellcome, the Wellcome Foundation. This is an interview with Dr. David Raznick. Raznick has been a major voice for those individuals seeking to challenge the existing dogma on AIDS. The interview was done in South Africa by Jean Mahoney. And let me just share a few moments of this before I go to my main report today. David Raznick saying, I have a PhD in chemistry from Georgia Tech, and I've been in the pharmaceutical industry since 1978. I've developed enzyme inhibitors for tissue-destroying diseases like arthritis, cancer, emphysema, parasitic diseases, and I've studied AIDS for 19 years. I've written about it in technical journals. 19 years ago, HIV didn't even exist. It was 16 years ago, in 1984, that HIV was unleashed upon the world at a press conference by Robert Gallo. Gallo used to be a member of the National Institutes of Health. He was one of the world's leading retrovirologists, and had been working on the virus-causing hypothesis since the 1970s, and he had to find viruses that cause cancers. He didn't find any. He tried to find something else useful or significant about retroviruses that led him to his claim that the retrovirus caused AIDS. Gallo's retrovirus, as we all know, is called HIV, human immunodeficiency virus. It is no such thing. It does not cause immunodeficiency. If HIV did cause AIDS, it would be one of the smartest viruses you could imagine, because it knows whether you're male or female, gay or straight, white or black. It even knows what zip code you live in and what country you live in. For example, in the United States, 8 out of 9 cases are men. In San Francisco, 99 out of every 100 are men. 2/3 of AIDS cases in the United States and Europe are gay men. And so that's a smart virus. And somehow that virus knows to cause Kaposi sarcoma in gay men, but not to cause Kaposi sarcoma in hemophiliacs, and not to cause pediatric AIDS cases, and not in IV blood transfusion or and so forth. So it's a very smart virus. You can either accept that, as the HIV establishment does, or you can be a little skeptical. As University of Berkeley retrovirologist Peter Duisberg, I and the so-called dissidents are, that maybe that's not quite the cause of AIDS. Peter Duisberg and I are convinced that AIDS in the United States and Europe is the clinical manifestation of the drug epidemic of both places. In Africa, it's a completely different situation. It's so different that the World Health Organization and other organizations in 1985 had to come up with a different definition of AIDS in Africa, because it did not look anything like AIDS in the United States or Europe. The Bangua definition came from a little town in Africa called Bangua. In fact, I'm pretty sure right now that there's no such thing as an AIDS epidemic in Africa. From my previous 2 trips, last May and this July, the reason that I say that in brief is that we've looked and looked and asked people, the government ministers, we've asked the director of the Medical Research Council in South Africa, the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, everybody we could. We ask, what are the numbers of AIDS cases in South Africa and how many AIDS deaths? No answer at all. Zero. To date, we do not have an answer to that, and in fact, I don't think there is any such thing as AIDS going on in South Africa. It's just the same old things that Africans have been suffering and dying from generations, due to poverty, malnutrition, poor sanitation, bad water, that sort of thing. We're calling it AIDS now, instead of by the old-fashioned names that were more honest. The interviewer. I think that most people don't realize there isn't a disease called AIDS per se, like cancer or leukemia. AIDS is a collection of what is up to now 30 diseases. Dr. Rasnick, 30 some odd, depending upon where you want to go, is very arbitrary. There are at least 4 definitions of AIDS in the United States, and the CDC has come up with, and there is no such thing as AIDS as a disease. All of these so-called AIDS-defining diseases are known and old diseases. For example, dementia, diarrhea, Kaposi sarcoma, cervical cancer, pneumonia. All of these sorts of things are only called AIDS if you have antibodies to HIV. Then you're called AIDS. In the absence of those antibodies, you have the old name of whatever the disease was. HIV itself has no symptoms. If you get a typical infectious disease like chickenpox, smallpox, or the flu, the symptoms go hand in hand with the causative agent. You know exactly what it is. The chickenpox virus doesn't cause dementia. It causes chickenpox. The flu virus doesn't cause cervical cancer. It causes the flu. HIV has no symptoms of its own. Once a person becomes so-called antibody positive to HIV, 10 years down the road, they can expect to get diarrhea, dementia, and you name it. So this whole idea as AIDS is a disease, there's no such thing. As a matter of fact, the name itself speaks to what it is. It's called acquired immune deficiency syndrome. It means an immune deficiency that is acquired in some way. It's a syndrome. A syndrome is, think of alcoholism. Alcoholism is a syndrome. We know the cause. It's drinking too much. But it can have a spectrum of consequences that aren't necessarily going to show up in each individual. In some people, alcoholism affects their central nervous system. Some people, it affects their liver. They get cirrhosis. Some people have gastrointestinal problems. There are all sorts of things that can be a consequence of alcoholism. Generally, syndromes are a consequence of some sort of environmental influence. Cigarette smoking, alcoholism, that sort of thing. Infectious diseases are typically not syndromes. They are very well defined, and you have very precise symptoms that are attributed to infectious disease. With syndromes, that's not true. Anytime you have a syndrome, it's most certainly not due to an infectious agent. So that's what AIDS is. It's not a disease, and HIV is an Orwellian deception. It's not an immune deficiency virus. It's just one of a thousands of retroviruses. First of all, you can't even find it in a human being. No one has ever obtained infectious HIV from a human being. That's why the test look for antibodies to it. HIV itself, at least the proteins of it, are produced in laboratories. For example, they mix a person's blood with those proteins and see if there's a binding reaction of some sort. If there is, depending upon its strength or whatever, you're claimed to be HIV positive. Normally, an antibody reaction, except for AIDS, AIDS is the only exception. If you have antibodies to the so-called putative effect or cause of, let's say, a disease, whatever it is, then you're considered immune and you're safe. That's the whole principle of vaccination. That's why you have a little scar on your shoulder from smallpox vaccine. People from around the world are happy to be around you because they know that you're not only less likely to get smallpox because you've been vaccinated, you're also not able to get to transmit it to other people because your immune system is now immune from it. Same is true with the measles, the mumps, the chickenpox. Once you've ever had it, you're immune to it. And if you were to check for antibodies to it in a person, you would find them because you are immune to it, and that's a good thing. HIV, lo and behold, is the only exception. If you have antibodies to HIV, that is a death sentence. 10 years from now, as I said before, you're going to come down with AIDS, defining diseases, and die, which is not true. The vast majority of HIV-positive people, well over 90% worldwide, are perfectly healthy. There's only a total of a little over 2 million AIDS deaths total worldwide. And yet they tell us that there are over 30-some-odd million HIV-positive people are still alive and living their lives happily on this planet. AIDS peaked in the United States in 1992, according to the CDC's own publications. We've had 700-some-odd thousand AIDS cases in the United States total. That's living and dead. The questionnaire says, what about HIV positives? Well, no, I'm not talking about HIV positive. I'm talking about AIDS cases documented in the past 19 years. Having those diseases, meaning that 30 different syndromes, Rasnick says, well, as of 1993, you don't even have to have a disease to be a full-blown AIDS case. You have to have two laboratory tests, fewer than 200 CD4 cells per milliliter of blood, and have an antibody to HIV, and have no other symptoms, no indication of illness other than a laboratory test, and you're a full-blown AIDS case. Well, over 60% of all new AIDS cases in the USA have no symptoms of illness. But yet, they're full-blown AIDS cases by the 1993 definition, and that's been true for over 50% of AIDS cases in the past 4 or 5 years. They have no symptoms of disease. So based upon whatever criteria the CDC chooses, even their very bizarre 1993 definition of including healthy people as full-blown AIDS cases, just on the basis of two laboratory tests, even including these tens of thousands of healthy people, there is still a grand total of 1 million Americans in 19 years, total, who are listed as AIDS cases. A little over 700,000, in fact. Curiously, even in Africa, the total number of AIDS cases is almost the same as there are in the whole country of the United States, even though they have 2.5 to 3 times our population. I'm talking about AIDS cases, not HIV positives. There are actually more sick people in the United States than the continent of Africa. There was, for a while, about 2 years ago, more documented AIDS cases in the U.S. than in the whole continent of Africa, yet they have 2.5 to 3 times our population. Now, this is Dr. David Rasnick, who is giving an interview. And mind you, he is a heavyweight in science, published author, in peer-reviewed journals. He is considered one of the fair-haired men of the AIDS establishment. But then he looked at the evidence and he turned against it. Here's what he says. Basically assume that, by using the African definition, the 1985 definition of AIDS in Africa, it doesn't even require HIV as part of the definition because they can't afford to do the tests in Africa. And so the test is totally unusable in Africa because of the false positives with hepatitis B, malaria, tuberculosis, which are endemic of sub-Saharan Africa. They use clinical symptoms. There are 4 basic clinical symptoms in the African definition. 10% weight loss, permanent fever, cough, and diarrhea. That's it. But think about it. I was in the Peace Corps in Paba, New Guinea, and I had all those. That makes me a long-term survivor based upon the definition of AIDS. Think of it. In a place like Africa, where you have random poverty, malnutrition, poor sanitation, bad water, and parasitic infections, guess what the symptoms are? And tuberculosis, too. Tuberculosis worldwide. Where you have poverty, you have tuberculosis, including the United States and Europe. It's a disease of poverty brought on by malnutrition. The world's leading cause of immune depression is malnutrition, which is typically due to poverty. Well-fed people who are exposed to TB do not get the TB disease. Anytime you have an endemic TB in a society, it's a clear indication of the level of poverty in a society. One of the symptoms of TB is a persistent cough. In 1993, they actually added TB to the 1985 African definition of AIDS. Isn't that interesting? Regular TB, which has been endemic there for how long, is now called AIDS in Africa. The questionnaire. The mainstream media is always reporting that dissidents like you and Duisberg have been discredited. But yet, I've never seen them show any evidence of that, and they never interview you, just the AIDS establishment doctors. I saw a recent piece on 60 Minutes, and it just showed how these doctors were infuriated with you guys. Rasnick responds, I'm sure they're infuriated because people call us dangerous, and I agree with them completely. Peter Duisberg and I, and other dissidents, we are very dangerous. The question is, dangerous to whom? We're certainly not dangerous to HIV-positive people. We're not dangerous to hemophiliacs. We're not dangerous to Africans. We are lethally dangerous to the AIDS establishment, to the people who are on that $8 billion a year taxpayer gravy train. In the U.S., every dollar that goes to AIDS, the $1.8 billion that goes to the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease only for HIV research, we're very dangerous to those people. We're dangerous to the careers and reputations of those 100,000 scientists and physicians who stake their careers and reputations on their bogus, contagious HIV hypothesis. We are dangerous to those journalists, politicians, and celebrities who have also attached their names and reputations to their bogus HIV hypothesis. So, indeed, we are very, very dangerous people, and that I admit. But we haven't killed anybody. As a matter of fact, as a consequence of our work, there are certainly thousands of people who are alive today that would not be alive had they been left alone with the insanity of the HIV hypothesis to drag them down in that spiral of taking the drugs that eventually caused the AIDS disease. You know, I heard this within this year that we had been discredited. That's news to me. We have been discredited? Well, that's all fine and good. All I ask is where and by whom? And when were we discredited? I could go back and see how we were discredited because it's all news to me. Anyone who says we've been discredited, show me the evidence. Show me any proof of our being discredited. The AIDS hypothesis is crumbling from within. It's like a former Soviet Union. The foundations are so poor. AIDS attracts probably the poorest quality scientists and the poorest, stupidest physicians you could imagine. I mean, David Ho is below mediocrity in his capability. I've met many of these people in the last 2 to 3 years, and there's one or two I've met that are really top-notch scientists. It's real pity that they have associated themselves with this stinking mess of HIV. The majority of them I've met are mediocre and below. Usually the higher up they are on the ladder, the poorer quality they are. Oh, they're rich. There's no doubt about that. Like Peter Duisberg said, most of his colleagues at Berkeley are now multimillionaires. A questioner, 10 years, it'll be gone? Rasnick, oh, 10 years, it'll be long gone. It's virtually disappearing in the U.S. There's almost no interest in it, even in San Francisco. The questioner, what about the recent news stories about how the epidemic has been expanding and exploding in San Francisco? Rasnick says, that's a sign of how fast it's disappearing. The fact that the AIDS HIV establishment in San Francisco and other places have to revive it, it's going away. So they go to these extremes and shoot from the hip and make these bogus statements that were in the newspapers recently about this burst of HIV infections and all that crap. They're lies. AIDS has always been fueled by lies, but now it's just getting more blatant. AIDS is disappearing in the United States. That's why Africa is now the newspapers, in the newspapers, and it'll be India probably later, and maybe China eventually. You know, that Texaco did, when Texas started drying up, no more oil, they moved east to Saudi Arabia and places like that. The AIDS establishment doesn't want to give up the gravy train, doesn't want it to disappear. They're not the brightest people in the world, but they're not crazy. This goes to the heart of our democracy. Our institutions are corrupt. They need to be restructured. The National Institutes of Health, the Center for Disease Control, are both military organizations. They have uniforms and ranks. A lot of people don't know that. They come under the executive branch of government. The president is their ultimate boss. Clinton, this summer, made AIDS a national security issue, which automatically brings in the FBI, the CIA, and the National Security Council and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's the problem when you have a national security issue. You can abrogate civil rights. We haven't felt the ramifications of that yet, but I know we will. The questionnaire, ironically, I remember many people, especially liberals like myself, going back being upset that Reagan ignored AIDS and didn't get the government involved enough. Rasnick says he did ignore it, but he screwed up. When he said something about it in 1984, that famous Gallup press conference, which got the snowball rolling. It was an election year, 1984. The first 4 years of AIDS were the first 4 years of his administration. He never said a word about AIDS before 1984, not one. Then there was a gay activist who was parading around the White House in the late summer. Well, late winter, I'm convinced that the April press conference was a preemptive strike that was meant to erase AIDS as a campaign issue. A lot of people say it brought it to the fore. I'm convinced it had the opposite intent, to erase it from any importance as a campaign issue. The April press conference was perfect in diffusing AIDS as a potential campaign issue because it said we figured it out. We got it all right. And it was another triumph for American science and medicine because an American discovered what AIDS is, and in 2 years we'll all be vaccinated for it, which would have been in 1986, 2 years into Reagan's second term. The questioner, so you think of it that the Reagan administration came up with? It did. It invented AIDS. But without thinking about it, it meant to diffuse it and take it off everyone's radar and say it solved it, it's over. As a consequence of that, he set off this avalanche we're now talking about, HIV/AIDS, without meaning to. He didn't mean to do it. It was a consequence of a political initiative by the head of state. The questionnaire, quickly sum up the AIDS drug epidemic correlation. Rasnick, we went from fewer than 10,000 chronic drug users in 1970, meaning heroin, cocaine, and amphetamines, to 25 million drug users in 1989. Two-thirds of them were gay men. These gays were using drugs at astronomical levels. the ones who got AIDS, far higher than the heterosexuals who are also using all these crazy drugs. These guys and the HIV drug users, which is a euphemism for heterosexual drug use, account for 95% of all AIDS cases. End of interview. That's an interview that is by a leading scientist, an ultra-orthodox thinker on all levels, who until he began to carefully evaluate the lack of credibility within the scientific argument, supported the AIDS community, was a researcher in it, helped create the antiretrovirals. He was one of the people who profited from the war on AIDS. And like thousands of others, has done a complete turnabout when he actually looked at the facts, because the facts did not bear out any more support for that. And now he's a major critic of it, and his arguments are reasonable. After all, get him one-on-one with David Ho or any of the other people and watch how they react. They'll tell you that they're interested in open debates. They're lying. This past summer, we filmed in Geneva the International AIDS Conference. It was last summer. This summer it was in Durban, South Africa. And I have footage of that as well. But here are all the leading AIDS dissidents, all respected scientists, all published in peer-reviewed literature, professors, professor emerituses, chairmen of departments, virology, microbiology. And there on the podium was Anthony Fauci and David Ho. These people had a part of the press conference where they were allowed to ask questions. When the dissidents politely took their turn, waited in line, went up to the mic, they were dismissed out of hand. Their questions and challenges would not be addressed. I filmed that. I filmed the look of on Gallo's face. I filmed the look on Anthony Fauci's face and David Ho's face. And these are the men of the apocalypse of the medical community on AIDS. Not once were they honestly addressed the issues and concerns of the dissidents. But we filmed those dissidents. I also filmed them in Kiev, in Ukraine, Italy, Germany, England, France, the Netherlands, and in several places in Africa. That final program is being edited now. I'm working on a few PBS specials, but the moment I get about 2 months uninterrupted, I will finish that Deconstructing the Myth of HIV documentary and present it, and I will announce when that will be occurring. I'm Gary Nolf. You've just joined us. Now let me go to a continuation of my own investigation. Let's take a look at the facts supporting the establishment view, and let's take a brief review of the issues. Having seen that media and many in the scientific and medical establishments have often steamrolled the public by asserting their views dogmatically while shutting out dissidents, we still need to consider the validity of their views. We have argued so far that many of the leading theses of the HIV equal AIDS camp have not been subjected to rigorous experimentation and verification. However, lest we follow in the footsteps of those who are raising objections against, let us keep clear that the seemingly unscientific practices of some of these scientists does not disprove the truth of what they are saying. A scientist may have made an earth-shaking, revolutionary discovery and still treat his or her colleagues shabbily and give the results to the media before submitting them to peer review. What we have to do is to separate out trendy journalism, herd mentality, pillaring of dissenters, and so on, that does not bear on the truth of what Gallo and his supporters claim. It neither disproves or proves their positions. So the truth, not the trappings of the orthodox view, must be our next subject of discussion. So in time remaining at least on today's program, I will turn to the views of dissenting scientists who dispute the findings of the AIDS orthodoxy. What we want to look at is whether establishment findings are replicatable and most central for this examination, properly interpreted. I'll begin by reviewing a fair number of issues concisely, the particular point here being to indicate the breadth of dissent. We look at in turn, one, the question of whether AIDS is a new disease, whether HIV causes AIDS, a point which includes the cofactor idea, the question of whether any retrovirus, such as HIV, could produce an AIDS disease, 4, questions about the strength of HIV, 5, the question of latency, 6, the problem of T-cell conditions when an AIDS patient dies, and 7, how increasingly Byzantine explanations of HIV mechanisms of action have failed. Then, remaining with brief consideration, but turning in less strictly scientific issues, we will note the problem of a discrepancy between money spent and results obtained, and a review of ethical complexities of the crisis, and finally, look at aversion programs. Now, following today's program, I'll take up 8 other issues in more depth on my next show on this next week. These will include the disputes over the scientific work of Dr. Gallo and his original 1984 linking of AIDS, HIV and AIDS, B, the question of what evidence there is that HIV plays a causal or casual role in the genesis of AIDS, C, an important discussion of the validity of the HIV test, then an examination of the thoughts of some scientists who believe there is no actual HIV virus in existence. It's never been discovered. And then the problematically shifting definition of AIDS, the inaccuracy of predictions that AIDS would spread through the general populations, the doubts being raised about the sexual transmission of AIDS, and finally, the whole thorny question of whether AIDS originated in Africa or whether it is widespread there. That's what I'm going to be doing for the next 10 minutes today, to complete today's program, and then what I'll be sharing with you next week. First, is there an AIDS disease? Let us begin by remembering how unprecedented AIDS is as an illness. With a tradition, life-threatening disease, one gets infected, meaning sick in some way, gets progressively worse and dies from it. With AIDS, though, you get the disease, it weakens your immune system, and you die from other diseases, and not always the same disease, but from one or more of a list of possible coincident killers. As Susan Sontag politely puts it, AIDS, quote, takes its identity from the presence of some among a long and lengthening roster of symptoms, symptoms which mean that what the patient has is this illness, unquote. One can readily imagine that this will cause problems with diagnosis. 2 patients die of tuberculosis in exactly the same way. One is found to have HIV infection, and the other does not. So one dies of tuberculosis, and the other is said to die of AIDS. It makes things complicated. Couldn't one at least argue, for instance, that it's really tuberculosis in both cases that's bringing death, and HIV is a non-life-threatening virus? And I'll take that problem up as much greater length on my next program. It is perhaps not surprising if some researchers are questioning whether AIDS itself is a new disease. In an interview I did in 1995 with author John Lauritsen, he said, quote, in a nutshell, the idea of AIDS is a phony construct. In the book, The AIDS Cult, he elaborates on this position, arguing, quote, the question must be raised whether AIDS even exists as a coherent disease entity. People are undeniably sick, but are they sick with a new disease requiring a new name? He sees AIDS as a sort of catch-all term that spuriously links 30 old and extremely heterogenic AIDS indicator diseases together with a presumption of HIV infection. Those who believe in AIDS as a new disease, he says, would have a case if indeed it was, quote, a serious disease of acquired immune deficiency without pre-existing or induced immune deficiency, unquote. The problem with that is, according to his explanation, quote, in all verifiable cases, demonstrable immune suppressive diseases and or treatment have always preceded the onset of AIDS. In other words, he finds AIDS patients have always had diseases such as syphilis, hepatitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, that weaken immune function before they come down with the syndrome. leaving him to believe AIDS is not a new condition, but merely a latter stage of an immune system deteriorating that began with the first illness. Lynn McTaggart went a step further when I interviewed her in saying that AIDS is a new medical condition, but one caused by the treatment, not HIV. You take a totally healthy person, you give them a completely unscientific test, and voila, they have HIV. And you give them a set of totally toxic chemotherapy-type drugs, which are known to have a range of side effects, including death, and then watch the progressive destruction of the person's immune system. This person, sure enough, dies. Of course, this wouldn't explain those who got AIDS before drugs were available, but its value in suggesting that some effects attributed to the AIDS syndrome may be produced by toxic cures is an idea that we'll bear looking at later. Secondly, does HIV cause AIDS? What about the cofactor concept? For the sake of deepening our argument, let us preliminarily accept the fact that AIDS is a new medical condition that has recently struck various populations around the world. The obvious first step in dealing with this calamity is trying to find out what causes the disease. The 1984 Bethesda Conference was touted as an awe-inspiring breakthrough because Robert Gallo had identified a retrovirus that seemed to be responsible for the disease. We have already remarked that his logic was strained at this point. Even if the HIV virus were found in every single AIDS patient, this alone does not mean that it played a casual role. Beginning with this argument, in the present and next few discussions, we'll examine scientific positions that dispute the point that HIV is behind the dreaded disease. Let's begin by noting the idea that HIV is a cofactor, an agent which is necessary but not sufficient to cause a disease, as having quite respectable of late. The prominent AIDS researcher, Dr. Root Bernstein, speaking for his team in The Scientist magazine, writes, quote, "We also at one time thought HIV alone is sufficient to cause AIDS, but such researchers as Luc Montagnier, Shai Ching, Lo, Joseph Sonnabend, and many others, including me, now believe that cofactors are necessary and therefore that HIV by itself cannot cause AIDS. Given that the presence of retrovirus in the blood of people with AIDS proves nothing in relation to whether that retrovirus causes or was caused by the disease." Nobel Prize winner Dr. Kerry Mullis, taking a Popperian position, comments, quote, "As applied, the HIV theory is unfalsifiable and useless as a medical hypothesis. I am not an agnostic," claims Dr. Fabio Franchi, a specialist in infectious disease and preventive medicine. He says, "I am well convinced HIV is harmless." The list of those who agree with these scientists include immunologist Dr. Edward Golub, president of the Pacific Center for Ethics and Applied Biology, Dr. Beverly Griffin, director and professor of virology at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School in London, Dr. Harry Rubin, professor emeritus of molecular and cell biology, University of California, Berkeley. When I was speaking with Dr. Rubin, I went out to the University of California campus, and he sat with me and talked about his views. He said, "There is no question that this so-called HIV virus has little or nothing to do with AIDS." And by the way, Rubin is one of the most respected molecular and cell biologists in the world. A name you may have recognized in Root Bernstein's list was Professor Luc Montagnier, who led the team at the Pasteur Institute who discovered, supposedly, HIV, called the then LAV, before Gallo. He is now backwatering on whether HIV is sufficient to cause AIDS. I called Luc Montagnier, I had an interview with him, and he backpedaled. Now, at the 8th International Conference on AIDS in Amsterdam, he stated clearly, quote, "I think we should put the same weight now on cofactors as we have on HIV," unquote. The case for labeling HIV as partially, not wholly, the cause of AIDS is summed up well by Root Bernstein. He notes, quote, "All AIDS patients do have multiple well-established cases of immune suppression prior to, concomitant with, subsequent to, and sometimes in the absence of HIV infection," unquote. If HIV infection in AIDS patients is always found with other debilitating conditions, he lists some of those chronic or repeated infectious diseases caused by immunosuppression, such as microorganisms. There would be hepatitis, syphilis, herpes, herpes 6, recreational and addictive drugs, anesthetics, antibiotics, and malnutrition. Then it seems reasonable to conclude that these factors are unnecessary HIV causative for the disease. Dr. Richard Stroman from the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology, Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, who I interviewed. By the way, he has devoted more time to studying the question of whether HIV alone was responsible for the immune suppression syndrome or not than almost any other issue he's been working on. And he found that those who laid full blame on HIV were using, quote, the same poor argument that we had for genetic predictability. He was referring to researchers who provide copy of such headline-grabbing stories as, quote, scientists search for gene that causes criminality. If you read the fine print in these scientists' findings, though, you'll find they say a particular, quote, gene is necessary but not sufficient. That is to say, by itself, this gene cannot be predicted to cause its possessor to become a pickpocket or a mugger unless combined with other factors such as environmental deprivation. However, that is tantamount to saying that supposed genetic causes of certain traits is no cause at all. Yet this implication, which would shoot down the whole argument, is never spelled out to reporters, and they are left to draw flashy but erroneous conclusions. Stroman says, quote, it's the same with HIV. If other conditions must be combined with it for AIDS to appear, full causality could be imputed to those other conditions, and HIV may well play no role at all, unquote. It was the outspoken criticism of Duisberg that interested Stroman, a genuine scientist who wants to judge for himself, not from hearsay, in looking into dispute. Duisberg himself, stung by the unmerited harshness of his treatment from traditional scientists, came back with this withering, semi-serious rebuke that turns on the cofactor argument according to an interview in California Monthly. He says, quote, some in the establishment consider HIV may not be sufficient to cause AIDS. A cofactor may be involved. Duisberg has discovered this cofactor. It is the establishment itself. HIV, he says, causes AIDS only under the influence of the National Institutes of Health and the CDC, their corresponding agency abroad, and interested drug companies, unquote. That completes today's discussion on part three of our continuing series on AIDS, A Second Opinion. I hope you've enjoyed the presentation and that at the very least it begins to open your eyes that this is not a closed discussion, that we should have more dissenting points of view, and hopefully by the time this is completed, you at least will be one of the people whose minds will be open to listening to all sides. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you very much for listening today, and we'll be sharing more on our next program on this. And finally, for those of you who live in the New York City area, I will be back on the air on Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. I've been preempted for the last 2 weeks because of ball games, but I will be on this Sunday evening for 2 hours, my first two-hour program in over a year and a half. Please join me at 10:50 a.m. on the dial Sunday evening at 8 p.m. Have a nice day, everyone.